Good morning. I'm very pleased to be back here again and have this opportunity to speak. So let me begin by thanking Roshi for the invitation, and also Howard and all the other people who handled the logistics. In the last few years, most of my talks have something to do with social engagement. So I just want to clarify at the beginning that, and I think this will be a relief to most of us, that I'm not going to say anything about you-know-who down in Washington. I mean, there's lots that we need to do, but that's not the subject of today's Dharma talk. Instead, I would like to give a talk on something that Chögyam Trungpa, the Tibetan teacher, once said. And if you saw the advertisement for this presentation, you're already familiar with that, right? Enlightenment is like falling from an airplane. The bad news is that there's no parachute. The good news is that there's no ground. When I first heard that a couple years ago, I was deeply impressed. In fact, I laughed a lot. I thought that was such a great way to encapsulate the process. So what I'd like to do is spend our time together sort of unpacking it, teasing apart the sort of elements of that analogy, the four main elements as I see them. That is to say, what's the airplane that we fall out of? Number two, how do we fall out? Number three, what's this parachute that we don't have? And fourth and finally, what does it mean to say that there's no ground? So, a Dharma talk, a teisho in four parts. Enlightenment is like falling out of an airplane. What's this airplane that we fall out of? Well, the simple way to say it is that it's our normal way of experiencing the world, including ourselves. So this normal understanding is that there's a me inside somewhere, maybe behind the eyes, inside the ears, and all of you and the rest of the world is outside. And by rest of the world, I mean it's a collection of basically separate things in objective space and time. So looking around the room here, there's lots of things, right? There's all of you, there's also pads and cushions, the wooden floor, the walls, the fan, my cup, my clock, my little stand here, my paperclip, etc., etc. And this is something we all take for granted. This is just the way the world is, isn't it? The point being, from a Buddhist perspective, this is not just the way the world happens to be. This is actually something that we have learned. That is to say, we have learned to see the world in this way. So in Mahayana Buddhism, there's a lot of talk about the two truths. Mm-hmm. And what they're really referring to, I think, is these two ways of experiencing the world. This normal way is what's called the relative, the conventional, sometimes the phenomenal world. And I quite like this analogy of a hand. When my hand is forming a fist, the idea is that this is the normal way that we tend to accept and take for granted. But there's also this other way of experiencing the hand. There's this other dimension, right? Perhaps the second most important person in the whole of the Buddhist tradition was this great Indian philosopher named Nagarjuna, who lived, we believe, near the end of the first century. And he was the guy who made, well, first of all, he's important for our lineage, right? He's one of the 28 Indian patriarchs. But he was also the one who really made this point that samsara and nirvana, that is to say, the ordinary way of experiencing the world, and nirvana, the way the world is experienced when we're awakened, that these aren't actually two different realities. In a way, he's sort of criticizing the way some people understand the Pali Canon or the Theravada tradition, where the idea is to somehow transcend this world, to go somewhere else, to escape it, not to be reborn after we die, right? And Nagarjuna is saying, no, we're not talking about two separate realities. We're talking about, in effect, two ways of experiencing this world. He says, the locus, I think the Sanskrit word is koti, the locus, the place that is samsara, that is to say, the world of a collection of separate things that arise and pass away, the locus, the place that is samsara, is not different from the place that is nirvana. And so it's this really important question, how can we understand that today? One thing we have learned, thanks to, say, child psychology, which became quite sophisticated in the 20th century, one thing we learned, of course, is that the child doesn't have the kind of sense of self. He or she is not born with the kind of sense of self that we develop later. And this is not only true for the individual, but we can also say that the child doesn't experience the world in the way that we do. This is something that we are conditioned into. As we grow up, we learn to see the world in the way that other people see it. We learn to sort of plug into a kind of consensus reality. And the problem is that we're not aware that this world, as we normally experience it, is a kind of collective construct. Rather, we sort of take it for granted as the real world, and we're not aware that there's other ways of experiencing it. We're not aware that we can deconstruct and reconstruct this world, which in a way is what our practice is all about. And when I say this world, of course, I'm including ourselves. To come to experience the world in a different way is to come to experience ourselves in a different way, because we're not separate from the world. In the earliest teachings, in the Pali Canon and the Theravada, the explanation for why we experience the world in the way that we do is basically craving or desire. If you know anything about the early teachings, the Four Noble Truths, right? We suffer, and why do we suffer? It's because of desire. But I don't know how it works here, but my Zen teacher, Yamada Koen Roshi in Japan, he never, that I remember, talked about the problem being desire. In fact, I don't think he ever referred to the Four Noble Truths. In fact, in the Zen world, at least in my tradition, we talked a lot more about the problem with concepts, conceptualizing, or you could even say just sort of language in general. And that was always kind of fascinating. Okay, what's the problem? Is it desire or is it language? It seems like, is there some kind of missing link there? And the reason I mention that is that recently I was reminded of another verse by Nagarjuna. I mentioned him a moment ago about samsara and nirvana not being separate realities. In the same nirvana chapter of his great work, the Karikas, he says, basically, when we experience the world with attachment to causes and conditions, we experience it as samsara. When we experience it without attachment to causes and conditions, we experience it as nirvana. Wow. And suddenly it clicked, because I can see that as kind of the missing link between craving, desire, and conceptualizing. Because our normal way, let me say it this way. I mentioned earlier that children, as they grow up, they learn to see the world in the same way that everyone else does. And a very important part of that process, maybe the essence of the process, is language, right? They learn to speak. And although we tend to assume that language is just about sort of, we see the world and then we give names to things, it's actually much more profound than that. That as a child learns language and learns how to use certain words, that is how they, in a way, are constructing reality. What do I mean by that? Okay, a minute ago I talked about all this seeing the world as a collection of separate things, including seeing this as a cup, right? As the child grows up, as we grow up, we learn to see the world as a collection of separate things, but not just separate things, right? When I call this a cup, I'm actually seeing it as a function. I'm seeing it as something that can be used to do something, to satisfy a certain kind of desire. I get thirsty, I want some water. What I'm pointing at here is that these three things work together. On the one hand, language, which is how we learn to divide up reality into these collection of separate things. And then the language involves deeply embedded within it at a very sort of unconscious level. We don't even know what's going on. But embedded in language is by learning the words for things, we learn to see the world as a collection of functions that we can then use to satisfy our desires. And that's okay, but the problem is in the process, we're missing something about the nature of the world right here and now because we see it in that way. There's something mysterious, there's something awesome, there's something magical about this world. We, in the Zen tradition, we talk about emptiness, but we tend to miss it because we're automatically at a very deep, mostly unconscious level, we're organizing the world so that we can see it as this collection of things that are here to kind of satisfy our desires, to do whatever it is that we want to do. And in the process, we overlook something really, really important. Anyway, we could go and say a lot more about that, but I think it's important to say a little bit more about this normal way of experiencing reality, because the really important thing that the Buddhist tradition stresses is that there's a dukkha, that there's a suffering, that there's some dissatisfaction built into it, right? I mean, why do we come to practice? Why do we meditate? I mean, for some people, a lot of people come to the path because of some deep kind of suffering in our lives, but even if it's nothing very, you know, physically or emotionally overpowering, why would we come and spend all this energy and time and money facing the wall, except that there's a sense of something missing, something isn't quite right, some sense of inadequacy. The problem isn't simply that we have these soft bodies that are subject to physical and emotional pain. We know from the Buddha's own story, right, the emphasis on death, on mortality. That as we go throughout our lives, what is it the existential psychology say? That our inability to accept our mortality is also our inability to live fully. There are two kinds of people, as someone said. There are dead people and soon to be dead people. Right? And, you know, we don't like to think about it. We're good at pushing it away. But the fact is, we know as self-aware human beings, we're going to die and we don't like that. And there's a kind of suffering built into that. But there's another kind of dukkha, another kind of suffering that I want to point to briefly. The way that I've been talking about the way we experience the airplane, this airplane world, is that it's really a construct. And one of the things that's constructed is our sense of self. But because the sense of self isn't real in the sense of self-existing, and by sense of self, I mean sense of separate self, sense of separation, the sense that there's a me inside and the rest of the world is outside. Because of that sense of separation, this sense of self we have, it doesn't correspond to anything real. There's nothing, again, I'm talking about the sense of separation, the sense that there's an inside separate from the outside. Because there's nothing real there, it means that the sense of self we have is inherently uncomfortable. inherently anxious, inherently insecure. And I think we all experience this as a sense of lack, as the feeling that something is wrong with me, something isn't right. I'm not good enough. That's one of the main ways it comes out, this sense of lack. What I'm suggesting is that the sense of separate self we have, this delusion, according to Buddhism, means that the sense of self is shadowed or haunted by this sense of lack, the feeling that something is wrong with me, I'm not good enough. And I think it's one of the great secrets of life. We all have this sense of lack, but we don't know that everyone else has it too. I look at all of you, you know, I can see you're quite real, but, you know, from the inside out, something is wrong with me, right? The problem, of course, is that depending on the kind of conditioning we receive, we tend to misunderstand this sense of lack. And I think this goes to the heart of the ignorance. We tend to project it outside ourselves. So what is it that I lack? Well, growing up in the United States, when I did, I learned pretty quickly what it is I lack. I don't have enough money, right? We all learn that. It doesn't matter how much money you've got, you don't have enough, right? Or I don't have enough consumer toys, or, you know, given the new possibilities of our digital media, I'm not famous enough, or I don't have a partner, or my partner isn't good enough, or, you know, we can go on and on, but we will always, the tendency is always to be conditioned to think what it is we lack is something out here. And it's tragic because this is a symptom of the deeper problem, which means that nothing we can ever get out here, no matter how much money, no matter how famous, et cetera, it can never be enough to fill up that hole at the very core of our being. The idea that somehow if I just get enough money, if I'm just famous enough, the term I sometimes use to describe that is lack projects. We have these lack projects. Or you can also call them reality projects, because another way to express the fundamental problem is that I don't feel real enough. And so if only I can become more famous, right, then somehow that'll make me more real. Or if I get rich enough or something like that, you see. So just to sum up this first part, this airplane world, as Nagarjuna emphasizes, it's not the only way to experience the world. It's something that we've learned. And growing up, learning how to use language, we've learned how to see the world in the same way that everyone else does. And the problem with that is the kind of suffering that I just referred to, that we also learn to see ourselves, that there's a dukkha, a basic dissatisfaction built into this airplane world. Does that make any sense?
No. Yeah.
Enlightenment is like falling out of an airplane. Part two, how do we fall out? And this is kind of interesting because there's a bit of a dilemma here, right? If we ask the question, well, do I jump out or am I pushed? To say that I would jump out, well, that makes it a kind of act of will. It's something that I'm doing. But as we know, it's not accessible to an act of will in that way. It's something that happens much more deeply. It's not something that the self can do in the normal sense. But if you say that we're pushed, does that mean, therefore, that we don't have to do anything? I mean, in a way, what do you do or what do you not do, right? You see, there's a little bit of a dilemma here. And what I think is fascinating is the way that this kind of tension, you see it in so many traditions, not just in Buddhism, but in other traditions as well. I mean, we see it in Zen. I think we see it in the tension between Rinzai and Soto. The Rinzai is much more the general kind of, and the Soto is more the rice farmer, you know, just sort of sitting with no goal, no duality between means and ends. But you find it more generally in Japanese Buddhism in the tension between jiriki and tariki, between self-power, which is basically like in Zen, right? In a way, we're doing something, we're doing Zazen. And the other power of Tariki, as in the Pure Land traditions, where they emphasize what's important is faith in Amida Buddha. So that, especially in Jodo Shu, when you die, if you have faith in Amida Buddha, he'll meet you and take you to his Pure Land, okay? Well, you see the different emphasis. Self-power, Zen, important to do this practice. Tariki, faith. Which is it? Also in India, there's this famous tension between monkey liberation and cat liberation. Have you heard of that? Right? Think of how the baby monkey has to cling to its mother's breast as the mother is jumping through the trees. If the baby doesn't hold on to the breast, it's going to fall, right? So the baby has to make some effort. But what about the mama cat with her kittens? What does she do? She picks up the little kittens by the scruff of the neck and takes them where she wants them to go. Same sort of tension. Do we have to do something, or is it something, are we taken care of in some way? And it recurs in Christianity a couple times. In the time of Augustine, there was this great debate between him and an English ascetic, Pelagius, who, you know, he emphasized more the things that we need to do, and Augustine emphasized more faith. And it comes out again, and this is one of the major causes of the Reformation, because at the time of the Reformation, you have the Catholic Church, which is giving you all these sacraments, and you have to do things through a priest and so forth. And then Luther comes along, and Calvin, and what do they emphasize? You don't need any of that. You read the Bible, you have faith in God, and either he'll take you to heaven or he won't. But you don't need the church. You don't need all that other stuff, right? So it's quite fascinating. But which is it? From our perspective as Zen practitioners, which is it? Right? Here I'm reminded of another quotation. Some people attribute it to Trungpa, others Suzuki Roshi. I'm not completely sure. Maybe Roshi here knows. Enlightenment is always an accident, but meditation makes you accident prone. Right? Sounds like Trungpa, doesn't it? Right. I mean, it's interesting. It's like there's not any clear cause-effect relationship between our Zazen and awakening. It doesn't work like that, right? We can't treat the Zazen as a means in that sense. It's not so... I mean, clearly there is some connection, but it's not that strict cause-effect one, right? We meditate, and sometimes something happens, right? I'm remembering my teacher, Yamada Cohen. He talked about, well... Let me mention first the famous Dogen quote that I'm sure you're all familiar with, where he says, to study the Buddha Dharma is to study the self. I think study, maybe inquire into is a better translation. To inquire into the Buddha Dharma is to inquire into the self. To inquire into the self is to forget the self, right? To forget the self is to realize your intimacy with the 10,000 things, or it's to experience this world in this other way, right? So, as Dogen puts it, the idea is to forget ourselves, and that I think is, you know, he's onto something there. It's, we can't, like the ego, the sense of self can't just forget itself. It's directly, let's say, okay, I'm going to forget myself. Well, but that's the whole point of the practice, as my teacher put it. In Zazen, it's the act of forgetting yourself in the process of becoming one with something. So in our tradition, we start with the koan mu, and, you know, in the practice, you become one with mu, and that's the way that you can forget yourself. What's interesting, though, is, and again, this is the subtlety of our path. All of this process, it's not something you can simply do, and it's not something that a teacher can simply do for the student, right? It's to sort of create the context and understand where the student is sticking and self-defeating, and to help them let go so the students can forget themselves. Right. One of the great Chinese masters, Poshan, said, "Boldly let go on the edge of the cliff. You only revive after death. But it's interesting that by working on something like Mu, getting really deep into our practice, we can come to the edge of this cliff, as it were. That is to say, to the brink of letting go of ourselves. But at a very deep level, sometimes there's this kind of automatic contraction that happens. You know, we kind of pull away from it, and you know, learning not to contract. Well, that can sometimes take some time in our practice, and that I think helps to explain some of those famous Zen stories that we all love, where the master sort of does crazy things and whacks the student when he or she isn't expecting it, right? If the student is ripe, if the student is ready, then something unexpected like that can help you let go. Enlightenment is like falling out of an airplane. The bad news is there's no parachute. The good news is there's no ground. What's this parachute that we don't have? Well, in a way, I think I already referred to it when I talked about these lack projects or reality projects. These are the ways that we try to secure ourselves. Somehow, we have this sense of lack, inadequacy, insecurity, unreality at the very core of our being. And if only I can just get enough of this and enough of that, since somehow, you know, then I will feel more real. And it's so tragic, because the whole point of these reality projects is, as I've said, that they're symptoms that don't address the fundamental problem, which means that they can never give us they can never fill up that sense of lack. That's not the way that we can really resolve that sense of lack. Another way to talk about it is, I would like to read a quotation from David Foster Wallace, a commencement talk that he once gave at Kenyon College, where I think, you know, I just think he expressed this so well. And of course, he was a master novelist, so he had this way with words. Let me just read a couple paragraphs from it. And again, I think what he's talking about is all the parachutes that we normally hold on to. And he talks about it he talks about these parachutes in terms of the things that we worship. In the day-to-day trenches of adult life, there's actually no such thing as atheism. No such thing as not worshiping. Everybody worships, right? All of us identify with, cling to something, right? The only choice we get is what to worship. And an outstanding reason for choosing some sort of God or spiritual type thing to worship is that pretty much anything else you worship will eat you alive. If you worship money and things, if they are where you tap real meaning in life, then you will never have enough. Never feel you have enough, it's the truth. Worship your own body and beauty and sexual allure, and you will always feel ugly. You know? If you worship your own beauty, you're never going to feel beautiful enough, right? And when time and age start showing, you will die a million deaths before they finally bury you. On one level, we know all this stuff already. It's been codified as myths, proverbs, cliches. The trick is keeping the truth up front in daily consciousness. Worship power. You will feel weak and afraid, and you will need ever more power over others to keep the fear at bay. Worship your intellect, being seen as smart. You will end up feeling stupid, a fraud, always on the verge of being found out. And as a professor, I know that one, you know. Oh, I'm really clever, I write books, Yeah, but there's always somebody smarter out there. There's always somebody who's going to come along and point out the error in your argument, and oh my God, I'll just, you know. So there's this sense of inadequacy, this sense of lack, right? If I'm identified with my intellect, that's the fragility. Oh my God, somebody will come along and reveal that I don't know what I'm talking about. Kind of thing. Look, The insidious things about these forms of worship is not that they're evil or sinful, it's that they are unconscious. They're the default settings, the kind of worship you just gradually slip into day after day, getting more and more selective about what you see and how you measure value without ever being fully aware that that's what you're doing. And the world won't discourage you from operating on your default settings, because the world of men and money and power hums along quite nicely on the fuel of fear and contempt and frustration and craving and the worship of self. Our own present culture has harnessed these forces in ways that have yielded extraordinary wealth and comfort and personal freedom. This freedom, this kind of freedom, has much to recommend it. But of course, there are all different kinds of freedom, and the kind that's most precious you will not hear much talked about in the great outside world of winning and achieving and displaying. The really important kind of freedom involves attention and awareness and discipline and effort and being able truly to care about other people and to sacrifice for them over and over in myriad petty little unsexy ways every day. That is real freedom. The alternative is unconsciousness, the default setting, the rat race, the constant gnawing sense of had and lost some infinite thing, the constant gnawing sense of having had and lost some infinite thing. Powerful, huh? That's at the very end of his Kenyan commencement address. You can actually hear it on YouTube. They recorded it. One thing that he doesn't talk about, and I haven't talked about, of course, is that one of the potent attachments, one of the ways that we can really cling, is to people, right? Maybe this has something to do with our long childhood, that, you know, we, much more than any other animal, you know, we're unable to cope for ourselves for so long. We're so dependent on authority figures. And there's a certain kind of relationship to authority. And there's this tendency to sort of, Ernest Becker talks about it very well. He talks about the spell cast by other people, the kind of charisma. And somehow we glom onto them. I remember back in the days when Reagan, I think he was a master, you know, as an actor, people really did that to him really well. But there's all kinds of negative and positive examples throughout history, right? And this also raises the question about a relationship with our Zen teachers too, right? I mean, I remember when I first met my teacher, he just walked across the room. He was going to the altar. He was going to give us some introductory words to start the session. And I guess I was ready for this kind of projection. But I just saw him as oh my God, you know, there's something about this guy. If Zen practice can make me like him, it's for me. And so, you know, the tendency to sort of put him on an altar. It's interesting. It's not necessarily a bad thing. I wonder sometimes if it's even necessary to some degree, at least for some of us, in that it really inspired me to practice. In fact, I'm wondering how much did I actually learn from him in the sense of what he gave me, and how much was it that he inspired me to practice to become more like him. But in any case, at a certain point, that transference has to be broken. You know, it's like one has to see the clay feet. Hopefully, by that time, one is ready to stand on your own feet, you know. If the transference happens too early, or if it's, you know, you think of all the scandals in our tradition, it can be tragic for the practice of a sincere student. But likewise, there are people who sort of never able to let go of that transference as well. And at a certain point, you know, we have to find the gyroscope inside ourselves, our own Buddha nature. You know, hopefully the practice has made us more aware of that. Regarding this process, there's Let me tell you a little story about my own experience, which is rather personal, and I don't always, or even intimate, I don't always, I'm often a bit hesitant to talk about it, but what I've noticed is sometimes it's been helpful to people. When I was living in Japan in the late 80s, living in Kamakura, practicing very intensely with my teacher, I had started in Hawaii many years earlier. I'd had a fairly early Kensho or passing Mu, and by that time in the late 80s, I was on my way. You know, I was just passing koans, and I could see that something was happening, and I was going to be a Zen teacher, and you know, I was on the career path, Zen teacher. Probably Roshi, who knows, maybe a great Roshi, you know, who knows, right? So Dogen Hakuin and David Loy, right? I hadn't had great enlightenment, you know, but I felt like I was getting close or something, right? So that's going on, but at the same time, I was reading everything I could about death and dying. Buddhism, philosophy, psychology, other spiritual traditions. I'm not totally sure why, but it was, I knew something important was happening there. And for me, by far the most fascinating, the most profound was reading Ernest Becker, the existential psychologist who wrote The Denial of Death, Pulitzer Prize winning, and his last unfinished book, Escape from Evil. And Becker was talking about how as self-aware human beings, we literally cannot fully accept our mortality normally, and so we tend to repress it in order that we can live. But his point is also Freud's point about repression. If you repress something, it doesn't work. It comes back. You have the return of the repressed in some distorted way. For example, it's what he calls immortality projects, right? So, you know, maybe we repress fear of death, but these immortality projects, these kind of compulsive ways to immortalize ourselves. So as a professor of philosophy, which is what I was, you know, a classic immortality project would be this deep need to write a great philosophical work that will survive my death, right? Right? The great work. In which case, it's Plato, Aristotle, Kant, and David Loy, right? Right? But he called them immortality projects because he was focusing on death. A little bit earlier, I gave the slightly different slant that it's not death, which, you know, for Becker, it's this fear of something that will happen in the future, but I think from a Buddhist perspective, it's more there's something wrong with this feeling of lack right now, that we're not as real as we'd like to be. But anyway, so here I am practicing, right, on this Zen career path, as it were, and then I'm reading Becker, and one night, the two just came together. And it was like, oh my God, the whole thing collapsed. You know, it's like, I could just see, I had been playing a game, that the Zen path was my immortality project, I was gonna become somebody special, you see? It was very disorienting. It was very painful initially. It was like the rug had been pulled from beneath me. But it was interesting. After a few days, there was a kind of a lightness. There was a kind of a freedom that, hey, I didn't have to play that game anymore. And it kind of opened things up in a new way. And then I started to wonder about that experience. And I was wondering, is that what was supposed to happen? Anyway, part four. And I realize I'm going on a bit here, so I'll try to cut it a bit short. Enlightenment is like falling out of an airplane. The bad news is there's no parachute, the kind of parachutes that the lack projects, the immortality projects, the reality projects, the worshiping that David Foster Wallace was talking about, kind of let those go. The bad news is there's no parachute. The good news is there's no ground. What does that mean? A little bit earlier, I quoted Pochon, boldly let go on the edge of the cliff. You only revive after death. But what's death here if there's nowhere, no ground to sort of crash into? Another of the great Chinese master, Huang Po or Wang Bo, I think he put it very well. He said, people are afraid to forget their minds, fearing to fall through the void with nothing to stop their fall. They don't know that the void is not really void, but the realm of the true Dharma. And then later he says, people do not know that their own mind is the void. Or maybe we could say the void is their own mind. Realizing something about the emptiness of the mind. That's the term that we use more often in English Zen, right? Emptiness. Kind of a tricky translation for the Sanskrit shunyata, right? Emptiness, okay, it refers to the fact that things are empty of self-existence. Things don't have any separate reality of their own. You can, in one way, what it's saying is that, and this is that other side that I was talking about, when we can see the world from this other dimension, everything is like a presencing or a manifestation of something that is a no-thing in the sense that there's, it has no qualities, characteristics. But this also is something about the nature of our own minds, right? That to realize the nature of our own minds, to realize the emptiness of our own minds, when they don't stick, because as long as there's this delusion of separate self that's always trying to secure itself, the tendency of the mind naturally is to stick. And when we can let go of that, then we experience the emptiness of our own minds in a very different way. Some people have suggested an alternative translation, not just emptiness, but emptiness fullness, you know, referring to trying to capture the idea that the emptiness of our mind is what, another way to talk about it is like it's a kind of matrix of possibility, infinite possibilities. Because the mind has no form, no qualities, no characteristics of its own. It can become anything. It can do anything. It can transform freely if it's not stuck. The point here is letting go is now that emptiness at the core, which before was experienced as a sense of lack, now it's not a sense of lack anymore. Because there's nothing there. The realization is that there's nothing there that needs to be secured. There's nothing there that could be secured. Which enables us to live in a non-abiding way, since the mind doesn't need to secure itself. The most quoted line in the Diamond Sutra, quote, let your mind come forth without fixing it anywhere. That's one translation. Let the mind arise, let it come forth without it fixing anywhere. The Diamond Sutra, like the Heart Sutra, those are two of the larger corpus of sutras called the Prajnaparamita Sutras. There's also the 8,000 Sutra, the 25,000, and the 100 line Sutra. But it's interesting, they're all making the same point about non-abiding. The very beginning of maybe the most famous in India, or the most commonly used, the 8,000 verse. This is the beginning. No wisdom can we get hold of, no highest perfection, no bodhisattva, no thought of enlightenment either. When told of this, if not we bewildered and anxious, a bodhisattva courses in the Buddha's wisdom. Nowhere do they find a place to rest on. Without a home they wander. Dharmas never hold them, nor do they grasp them. Like the Buddha himself, freely they wander without a home. Just so, without a support or a basis, without a ground, the bodhisattva is standing. That line I quoted from the Diamond Sutra, it's often believed that that's the line that precipitated the great awakening of the sixth patriarch. And certainly his own teachings make and remake the same point. Quote, this is from the Platform Sutra, when our mind works freely without any hindrance and is at liberty to come or to go, we attain liberation. Such a mind, he says, quote, is everywhere present, yet it sticks nowhere. And in accordance with that, he said that he had no Dharma to teach, to transmit to his students. Quote, what I do to my disciples is to liberate them from their own bondage with such devices as the case may need. There's more to say here. There's always much more to say, but I think that might be a good place to stop for the time being. May we all realize the true nature of our non-abiding minds. Thank you.